From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is The Treatment.
Shake it, don't break it. Welcome to The Treatment, which you can also hear at KCRW.com. This may not be the year of Paul Feig, but certainly the spring of Paul Feig. Just recently, he did the big Steve Carell departure episode of The Office as director. His newest film, Bridesmaids, stars, and it's co-written by Kristen Wiig, reunites him with his collaborator, Judd Apatow. As a director, of course, he's done Parks and Rec, Mad Men, many episodes of Nurse Jackie, and many landmark episodes of The Office. He's also a published writer. He's done several books of young adult fiction, and the last time he was here for his self-mocking memoir, Super Stud. It's good to have him back. Paul, thanks for being here.
Elvis, I'm so happy to be back.
It's good to have you back. It's interesting because Bridesmaids, in the abstract, almost sounds like the kind of movie that would be not the kind of thing you'd do.
I love working with women, and I've always wanted to do female, strong, you know, projects. To me, Freaks and Geeks was so much Lindsay's show, and I always loved that character and love writing for women. And writing, like, strong women characters who aren't so strong that they're not, you know, realistic.
And you also did a number of episodes of the first season of Weeds to really sort of cement the characters there.
And Nurse Jackie, too. I mean, talk about a strong female character. So, you know, so when Bridesmaids came along, it was more, I was such a fan of Kristen's. I actually, unbeknownst to me, I cast her in her very first film, which was this Christmas movie I made years ago called Unaccompanied Minors. And it was a tiny part. And then just kept up with her, would run into her on film sets and at Saturday Night Live. And so when this project came around, it just seemed like such the perfect showcase for her. And then it had the added bonus of it. It had such strong female roles in it.
And we should say the movie's about Bridesmaids, about an upcoming wedding that goes incredibly wrong.
It goes wrong for this one woman, for Kristen especially. Yeah, I mean, to me, it was never a wedding movie. Here's why wedding movies get made. It's structured like a movie. There is the beginning, which is someone gets engaged, so that's exciting. It kicks it off. Then there's these parties, you know, that kind of come up, the engagement party and a shower. And then there's, you know, things especially for bridesmaids or for you know, grooms get their bachelor party. But it's this building thing that moves towards a big climax, which is the wedding. So it's, by movie terms, it's kind of perfect. There's the structure, and you just kind of insert whatever story you want into there, but the character motivations are all there. So to me, it's two things. It's a friendship movie, and it's about a friendship between two women. We're still trying to figure out what the best term is. Is it a womance? Somebody told me it could be a bromance.
But are you comfortable with the constant comparisons to The Hangover for women?
I don't mind it. Look, their box office, and there'd be nothing made me happier if we were the female Hangover. I think the comparison comes up just because they're both movies about funny groups of people, and they're both movies that have fairly outrageous stuff going on in them. But then we kind of separate from there because I don't want the message to get out to women that this is like a movie that's just trying hard to be make women like guys. And that's not this. This was about trying to make a movie where women are talking honestly and acting like women and having real women kind of interpersonal relations. And we did that by having a great script from Kristen and her writing partner, Andy Mumolo, and then empowering all the women in the movie. We hired very improv-heavy people and then had them come in, and everyone weighed in. So they really built these organically, these characters.
It's The Treatment. The man who just so aptly described his new movie, Bridesmaids, is its director, Paul Feig. You can hear the show at KCRW.com. But I think that the movie fits into your strengths, where you so often deal with characters who want the best and totally incapable of delivering it.
I'm obsessed with people who are eternal optimists, who are trying to do the right thing, and who are also trying to figure out their place in the world. I think that's the eternal question. I know for me, I feel like I can never figure out where I fit on this planet for some reason. But I think that's a very relatable feeling, and it's something that you root for people because there's an earnestness about it. In order to follow somebody for 2 hours, you really have to feel that there's something there that you want them to get. And I think this is in a way where maybe men and women have a different standard they're held to in movies.
How do you mean?
I think it's easier to have a character who's just like a complete slob, like never got his life together dude, because I think it just looked at like that's kind of how guys are. And I don't know, none of this is fair, any of these comparisons, so I'm not saying them like this is, I believe in this, but I think there's a feeling of like that for women need to be a little more together. Like there's less tolerance for a woman who's a disaster.
But these women Kristen especially is kind of a disaster.
She's a disaster, but here's what we did different. Because you meet her and she's a mess. She's in just like a horrible relationship. She's got a terrible job, you know, living with weirdos. But there's a scene about a half hour into it. First of all, you find out right towards the beginning she had a bakery, a business she started, and then it went out of, then it failed. And it failed because of the recession. So right there you get a thing of like, oh, okay, well, she was together at one point. She did pull something off. And then the second thing is a half hour in, you see her in her bedroom by herself and kind of a down moment looking at her wall of what the bakery used to be. And there's these articles and clippings from the opening day. And there's this really important shot she's looking at of her in front of her bakery from the newspaper, like arms crossed, looking confident, smiling, and really strong. And then you kind of cut to her looking at it, and she's much more kind of down and you know, beaten up by life. And then right after that, we have a little montage of her making a cupcake and like a very artful, you know, really skillful bit of baking and decorating.
She's capable of accomplishment.
Right. So then what you do is you go, she was this person. I want her to get back to who she was. So you're more rooting for her to regain what she had. It's not like, because then it's not believable. It's like somebody's a disaster. Then you get a movie where you're kind of like, and at the end they have this amazing epiphany and they change their life, which is not really that believable. We only change in small increments. So this is like getting her back to where she was and then getting her a little further. So now you know, okay, she's not going to keep screwing up. She's in a better place in her head.
But you also said too that she's really invested in making her commitment to this wedding pay off because that's something she needs to for her own sense of accomplishment as well.
It's for her own sense, and it's also filtered through. It's all about trying to save her friendship with Lillian. Lillian's the only thing, her best friend is the only thing she has that's solid in her life when she's a disaster. And they're both at the same level. And it's that nice thing when you're at the same level, your friend, like at least you go, okay, I'm not the only one that's kind of struggling. And all of a sudden her friend gets engaged and gets engaged to a guy who's pretty well off and is going into a world where she's suddenly a member of a country club and she's doing really well. And then she has a woman who is in another bridesmaid who is perfect, who, you know, played by Rose Byrne, who's got everything. She's rich, she's beautiful, she's together, she's taking Lillian on trips behind, you know, that Annie doesn't know about, Kristen's character. And so it's her trying to hold on to that friendship. And it's almost like she wants to do well to prove to Lillian what a good friend she is and to show Rose Byrne's character that she's, you know, she's not a loser, that she's not the mess that she appears to be to Rose's character.
I think the term you're looking for is comedy. It's The Treatment. My guess is director Paul Feig. His new comedy, if I can use this term loosely here, called Bridesmaids. But one of the things that I figure you went for this movie because it's so key to the comedy of awkwardness, which is something mm-hmm. that you are particularly gifted at and interested in finding that, in finding also by playing it straight. I mean, you don't play broad comedy, y'all. Even though there's broad comedy stuff that happens here, you don't play it broad.
No, well, it all has to come out of reality. I mean, Judd and I are have always been, this is what we bonded over this, you know, we've known each other forever, but when we did Freaks and Geeks, it has to be honest. You have to come from a very honest, real story with real people, real characters acting in real ways. So if you set up, this is a real person who makes weird choices, then you'll go with it. But if just people just do left turn things in service of the comedy, what happens is then at some point you're forced to shove in the drama or the story or the emotion. And that's why you get a lot of comedies that kind of are funny, 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 funny. And then you get jammed in some like maudlin scene or where you're kind of like, it always slows down like in the third act sometimes. It's like, and they're like, okay, we've done the comedy. Now let's hit the story. And so, but I feel it because it's not coming organically out of these characters on this real journey. Once you lay that very firm foundation and treat it like a drama when you're first plotting it out almost. You know, and it's funny, when I try to pitch stuff like at studio sometimes, they're like, well, it doesn't sound funny. It's like, yeah, don't worry. The funny will come. We'll hire funny people. We'll get funny actors. We'll get, you know, other people in there. That will come. But if you don't engage in that story, people are just going to zone out. You're only going joke to joke.
Because as we're talking about this, I guess there are a couple of things that come to mind for me. One is that your real strength, I think, as a director is finding ensemble pieces where there's one person who's kind of the nominal lead, but not really. I mean, you basically feel, and there are six bridesmaids here, and you service all the characters. Mm-hmm. And I feel that's something that's a real integral part of the way you work, that it has to be a group of people. It can't just be one person.
I like people talking amongst themselves, and I like friends or I like acquaintances kind of talking. I really love when there's like just a dinner table scene or like, you know, sitting around the poker table or whatever it is of people just talking, because that's what so much of life is. And there's so much funny stuff. That's every time I've had funny conversations in my life, it's been in sort of intimate situations like that with people. And so it's fun to have a lot of characters around because they can all kind of represent different things and they can all weigh in. I mean, it's a fun way to just show different ways of thinking and playing different jokes, because you got, you know, different attitudes out there. The problem happens is when you get so archetypal with them that you don't break out of that, and you kind of like, you know, the weird guy is always weird, and the, you know, the uptight guy is always uptight. It's fun, and that's,
but
you know,
isn't that more stereotypical than archetypal, really?
Well, it's an archetype that you don't have any fun with in a way. I mean, it's sort of apples and oranges, but I get you want those archetypes in there because they represent things. Like in Bridesmaids, you know, we have the fresh faced, excited about marriage, newlywed. We have the woman who's been married too long and she's kind of done with it, and then you have the single who's sort of the out man hungry single, which represents a little Greek chorus of ways your life could go. So then when you put Kristen in the middle of that, she's seeing, you know, okay, well, there's old married life. Maybe that's not so great. New married life seems a little naive. And then, but single life could be a nightmare, could be fun. It's just ways to get, you know, get different points of view. And honestly, just comedy-wise, it's just ways to get different types of jokes in there and different types of behavioral comedy.
Because I think to what you've done The Office, and again, as I said, you've done some of the landmark episodes, but you're also dealing with, again, somebody in Michael Steve Carell's character who so desperately wants to be the right person and do the right thing.
Yeah.
And unlike Kristen here, but like many characters you've used, completely oblivious to the effect he has on people.
Right. He is why I think there are so many, you know, why there's sexual harassment lawsuits and all that kind of thing. It's so much of it, you know, clearly there's jerks out there, but a lot of it stems from people with really bad senses of humor. And so that's what I love about Michael. He is the embodiment of, like, the guy just wants to be accepted, wants to be funny, thinks he's hilarious, and it's grating because he's not, you know, in real life, the man's hilarious, but Michael Scott is not funny, but he thinks he's funny, or he's funny in unintentional ways.
And in that episode, that last episode you directed, it's interesting because it's a farewell episode, but you're making a farewell episode about a guy that most of the people in the show don't really like.
Well, that was the biggest challenge. That was the biggest challenge with this because, you know, behind the scenes, Steve Carell on the set of The Office is one of the most beloved people in the world, and he deserves it. He's so nice. I mean, he's getting out of the van on location. He waits and helps all the makeup ladies out of the van before he'll go. I mean, he's just the sweetest man in the world. So you had that dynamic, which is, oh my God, we're not going to see Steve Carell on the set anymore. So that's gutting for the whole cast and crew. But like you say, in the reality, in Michael Scott's world, Michael Scott is leaving Dunder Mifflin, where people kind of tolerate him. He has a relationship with, like, Pam and Jim, kind of, and Dwight, but even that gets tenuous at best. So when we were shooting it, it was this tendency to want to make every, not want to, but it was just happening where people were getting very heavy about it. All, I mean, I'm talking about behind the camera too, like Greg and I just kind of, and it's like, wait.
You mean Greg Daniels, the creator of the show.
Yeah, who's a brilliant man. And his whole thing, he was like, we got to make sure that we're not being sadder than the audience is. And it was true, because if you have a boss that's kind of a weirdo leaving, you might get a little sentimental about him leaving, but you're not going to have a breakdown about it. So it was really riding that tone was difficult.
Well, before I have a breakdown, we'll take a break. My guest is director Paul Feig. His new feature film as director is Bridesmaids. More to come. It's The Treatment. Stay tuned.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. My guest is director Paul Feig, whose new movie, which reunites him with producer Judd Apatow, is Bridesmaids. When I saw you at South by Southwest, where I saw the film, mm-hmm. you said something interesting. You talked about being in movie jail.
Yes. Oh, I've been in movie jail for about 5 years.
Because?
Because of a little movie called Unaccompanied Minors.
Which actually has its roots in public radio. It comes from This American Life.
Yeah, it was one of Ira Glass's, you know, from his show. I was very happy with the film. There was issues that I had of, you know, things behind the scenes that happened where we had to change script things I didn't want to change and blah, blah, blah. Every director in the world can tell you these stories. But I was happy with the outcome, and we would do test screenings of it, and it would test in the high 90s with audiences and kids. So that, you know, you can't do much more than that. But look, it just either a movie clicks with an audience or it doesn't. And the if you have a movie that comes out and it doesn't make much money, then you are not that sexy to the town anymore. So it's a bummer. You're kind of always hoping you can get out of it. And thankfully, Judd showed up and pulled me out of movie jail, which was very nice of him.
Had you talked about doing other movies with him before Bridesmaids?
We were always trying to figure out something to do. We've been wanting to work together. We haven't worked together since Freaks, other than I directed one episode of Undeclared. But we're always talking about it and couldn't quite figure it out just because we want that perfect thing. We just have a very distinct voice when the two of us work together and needed that project. So it wasn't until this one popped up that was like, yeah, that's it. Because I was really wanting to do something with strong female, you know, characters and actresses. So this felt like the perfect mix.
Because one of the things that you're really interesting at is casting. I mean, if we look at the cast of Freaks and Geeks, and then from Linda Cardellini to Carla Buono to Busy Phillips to James Franco.
Oh, it's crazy. Yeah.
It's an incredible cast and a group of people that you basically found as they were figuring out who they were as actors. Mm-hmm. And you're in a different situation here. You're trying to find actors, actresses, if you will, who have to score, but I was guessing you didn't want too many people to be able to make associations with them.
There's plenty of stars I want to work with, like big movie stars, but to me it's just more exciting, like who have that discovery. Let an audience have that discovery that we have. It's nothing more exciting than in an audition to somebody comes in who you don't know and they blow you away in the room. Then you're like, wow, okay, this is great. I'm having the discovery that now an audience will have when this person comes on the screen and surprises them. Or even if somebody they might have seen in a few things but don't know, haven't read about them in the tabloids and all this kind of thing. So that just it's exciting. And then it's I don't know, just I was an actor for so long and struggled for so long as an actor. There is something exciting about giving somebody their shot. And that sounds far more charity-based, because it's not. We're not going to put anybody in something that doesn't just kill, that isn't great. But when you find that person that's great, and if it was somehow to come out, well, you can have this star who's really good, or you can have this unknown who's just going to kill it. It's like, well, give me the unknown who's going to kill it.
Well, the guy who put everybody together for this big tent show is my guest director, Paul Feig. His new film as director is Bridesmaids. It's The Treatment, which you're going to hear at KCRW.com. But it feels like in a lot of ways, the comedy you were doing over 10 years ago with Freaks and Geeks has finally found its way into the mainstream.
But what we are in right now is my favorite type of comedy, which is behavioral comedy. It's all not based on jokes. It's based on interactions, how people are reacting to each other.
True situation comedy, isn't it?
Very much so. Yeah, I find it more relatable. And I think, look, you can try to trace where it comes from. I think the internet has a lot to do with it, because we're inundated by so many real-life videos that are so funny that that's the funniest stuff out there. It's kind of things that just happen, or people being weird, or, but who are real people. And I think that's why reality television, people like it so much. It just feels more vital.
But I just feel like part of it, too, is that there's a kind of comedy you do where if you look at the show that was big at the time of Freaks and Geeks, it was Friends. And that's the kind of comedy that's based on people who look like they should be on television. I mean, they look like stars.
Right.
And your bent, to me, is always to cast a person who might be like three or four chairs over on an episode of one of those archetypal, if you will, shows from 10 years ago.
Yeah. I mean, again, it's just having no criteria other than you have to be really funny and you have to be really good. This goes all the way back to Freaks and Geeks when we went in and I knew NBC wanted to buy it, and I went in with Judd because we were, going in to kind of have our meeting with them. And I'm saying to Judd,
he was just coming off Larry Sanders at the time.
Yeah, so he was hotter than hot. And I remember just saying to him, like, okay, we cannot cast this with like beautiful kids and then put glasses with tape on their glasses and say, oh, they're nerds. That thing, like her hair's up in a bun, so she's ugly. Oh, I know, she's gorgeous because she took off her glasses. We want to cast this real. And we got into the room and I made that little speech and they were like, no, we 100% agree. So it was like the easiest thing in the world. They were all on the same page. I think people become attractive once you put them on screen anyway. And if they're acting in a way that you enjoy, almost even with the French cast. I mean, maybe if you saw them outside and if you never knew they were on a show, they might look different to you. You know what I mean? They don't have that. There's that glow and aura about somebody who's suddenly famous. I can never figure out. Like when you meet somebody famous, there always feels like there's like an energy around them. But do we supply that energy or do they have that energy?
What do you think? Because you've seen so many people like James Franco, for example. When you met him, did you know he was going to be a star?
One thing I can tell you is when somebody comes into the room and they do great, there is a different energy in the room. And I can only sum it up as charisma. I do think charisma exists, you know, and it is like a physical thing. I don't know where it comes from. I don't know. I'm fascinated by it. I almost like to do like body energy studies on it or something like that. Is there aura going? This sounds so new age. Going towards the camera because that's me. I've got my crystals and I.
Give me a minute while we hit the symbol here. It's the treatment. I'm looking for my dream catcher. My guest is director Paul Vig. His new film as director is Bridesmaids. But as you talk about this, one of the things that I'm even thinking about this when I reread a Superstud last night.
Oh.
You've often talked about encountering people and just the way the room changes.
Yeah.
In terms of Bridesmaids, somebody, for example, Kristen Wiig, who people know from seeing her on SNL, but she's never the same. I mean, she's had a few regular characters, but her chameleon-like quality is what makes her such a key element of that show. Mm-hmm. And every time she's in the movie, it's that process of discovery for audiences because she's played so many wildly different characters.
And that's what one of the things that drew me to it, just knowing, because I know what a good actress Kristen is, and I've seen her in stuff, and I've seen her not being funny, you know, being more dramatic or grounded, and she's so good at it that I love the big crazy characters on SNL. That's so much fun because that's that medium, that's that format they're doing. But I mean, she's such a deep actress, and that was the thrill because, like, I'd be telling people, you know, what movie are you doing? Like, Bridesmaids, and their eyes would glaze over, first of all, because, like, oh, it sounds like, you know, it's going to be a crappy wedding movie. And then it's like, oh, who's the star? Kristen Wiig. And I could see their face, and they like her, but it had that look of, like, oh, so it's going to be, like, you know, the Target Lady movie, or it's going to be some big, you know,
kinda, a sketch movie, basically.
Yeah, a sketch movie. And I'd always be like, oh, you have no idea. You just see it. You get, you know, wait, hold off judgment. And that's the thrill, is why. Watching the movie and people are just like, oh my God, they can't believe how good
she
is.
You're talking about something interesting, which is the expectation people have about SNL movies or movies with SNL actors in, because so many of them have been so many of them have been like sketch type films,
right.
And people almost feel like, oh, I know what this is going to be before I see it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't say it's baggage, but that is something that happens because you don't know. But I mean, but then, you know, look at Will Ferrell, who's great. They walk these two worlds. They can go into the big crazy movie, or they can do a grounded type film. It just depends on, really depends on the person. I mean,
Will's kind of a different case because he did a lot of movies that weren't SNL type films. I mean, he had small roles in things like Austin Power films.
Yeah.
And all the kinds of movies where he got to score and not be associated with bringing one of those characters. But for the most part, when you hear that a Saturday Night Live performers in a movie, given that now they've been movies, these kind of movies in effect since the Blues Brothers, we think we know what we're going to get.
Yeah, it's true. It's a very interesting thing. When you're a sketch actor or you come from sketch comedy, it's a dicey road. There's some people that can make the leap and some people can't. And it depends on what their real-life personality is, because some people are kind of like Peter Sellers, who they come alive when they're these characters, but then in real life, they're whatever issues they have with their personality, or their maybe the charisma goes away. And I've seen that with some of the people who've come out of that there, and they're really good sketch people. But then when they play themselves or versions of themselves, they just become not quite as interesting. And what's great about Kristen is she's so deep in that way that she's compelling. People like her. In this movie starts with, you know, kind of a big crazy sex scene, and then there's this funny scene where John Hamm's trying to kind of kick her out in the morning. And we had all this stuff that we did where he was being pretty mean to her and saying pretty mean things, but
meaner
really
than he is in the movie anyway?
Yeah, kind of more a-holy. And we thought it was funny because he was so funny at doing that. He's just the funniest guy. And so we cut it together. We were cracking up. We showed our kind of comedy hipster friends. They all cracked up. So we're like, wow, we got this really strong opening scene. Showed it to a real audience, and they didn't laugh. And we realized very quickly they like her so much that there was nothing funny to them about a guy being mean to her. So that right there, you go like movie star, you know, the movie's great. It's going to work great because people are invested in her. They're going to follow her. And B, she's got that quality where people care about her right out of the gate.
What's fascinating of her as a, about her as a film actress is that she tends to slow down in front of the movie cameras as she realizes that she doesn't have to make an impact right away.
Yeah.
And I wonder how much of that for her is sort of instinctive and how much of that stuff that you get to pull out of her as a director.
She's very instinctive about that. That's why I think we all get along, because it all fits in with the story has to be grounded, the characters have to be grounded. You know, she realizes, she knows the mediums she's working in.
But one of the great things about it too is that there's real chemistry between her and Maya Rudolph.
Yeah.
That clearly relates to the friendship between the two of them you were talking about, but also that Maya is capable of that kind of emotional grounding as an actress that you're talking about as well.
Oh, no. I mean, she, you know, Maya is such a great actress. It's fun because, like, going like, we really should cast, like, a really, you know, close friend of Kristen's. Oh, it just happens to be Maya Rudolph, one of the funniest, most talented people on the planet. That worked out well. She's great because that's a tough role she has, because she is sort of the grounding role in the movie. And
for a while, kind of the straight person.
Oh, yeah, very much so. And she's so funny. But she finds that way to have that natural energy where she can be funny and cool. I see everybody who watches the movie, they really kind of get invested in her because she seems like the person you want to have as your best friend. I mean, you completely buy that Rose Byrne would be like kind of trying to pull her close because she's just like this cool, free spirit.
It's, yeah, because I guess I wonder, too, in terms of the casting, because it's a film, you really got to sort of sit and work with the actresses. And I know that your interest so much is in finding people who can do improvisational stuff as well as stick to the script.
Yeah.
How much time you had to work with the cast once you got all these women set for the film? Did you have a long time to rehearse?
Yeah, we cast early. We tried to cast early because we considered casting as part of the writing process.
Ah.
Look, none of us are as writers and as people who know structure and story, can come up with everything. You know, if we have a limited toolbox, we're all going to come up with, because we just go from our own personal experience. So if very talented people who are also improvisational actors or who are used to bringing out their personalities come in, why would you ever cut off that huge resource of creativity and ideas? We have this amazing cast of these great people that, I mean, a lot of them were people that Kristen had worked with before. Like, they were all groundlings. There's a lot of groundlings in this, which is that an L.A.-based improv theater and troupe.
That's been kind of a conduit for Saturday Night Live over the years.
Yeah, very much so.
Well,
that and Second City are kind of the place where you go to find funny people. But when they start improvising, it's just like, then you're like, oh, my God, she's coming up with things about she's weird about her kids. Or she's like, the housewife takes so many meds that she knows in detail about the meds. And so you start going, oh, that's an interesting route. That's an interesting route. And we're like vampires. We kind of like feed off of that. Of like, oh, that's a way to go. That's a way to flesh this out. Even if it's for the smallest of arcs, or if it's just for jokes or moments and scenes, that just will give it that third dimension and open it up beyond what we all kind of thought it could be.
We're out of time. Thanks so much for doing this, boss. It's good to have a fellow Detroiter back on the show.
Elvis, it's so great to see you.
Thanks.
Thank you, everybody. Sorry for going on and on, everyone. Please go back to your regularly scheduled programs.
I'll take a minute to let people know our recording engineer here at the Argo Studios in New York is Paul Ruess. The show is mixed by J.C. Swadek. It's edited and produced by Gemma Dempsey. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
An audio archive of this and other programs can be found at kcrw.com. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.